Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, a follow-up program to a recent live symposium on the management of ovarian cancer at the 2023 ASCO Annual Meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David O'Malley from the James Cancer Center at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, to discuss recent advances and future direction in the care of patients with ovarian cancer. To begin, I asked Dr. O'Malley to provide his perspectives on key presentations in ovarian cancer at the ASCO meeting.
Well, you know, DUO-O really is the main large phase 3 trial, which has come out here recently. We're waiting to see the manuscript there and more granularity into some of the data which presented. Obviously, it was a positive study statistically. The question really is the clinical relevance of this with regards to the missing arm of a PARP plus BEV, in this case, olaparib plus BEV, and really where would that have fit? So cross-trial comparisons, challenges there are difficult for us to say, is the addition of IO here really adding much to the outcomes?
Could you review basically the design of the study what they found?
Well, DUO-O had a three-arm trial. It was the only trial of the four other trials which required all patients to have BEV. So each arm have BEV. So you have an active comparator, similar to the POLO-1 data where everybody had an active comparator. So the three arms were the historical control arm, which was carboplatin paclitaxel followed by BEV maintenance. That was the control arm. And then the second arm, and this was all placebo controlled, the second arm had Durva in it plus BEV. And then the third arm, what I call the triplet, was Durva, BEV, olaparib. And that was the main statistical analysis, was arm C versus arm A. And you see there from that design that you're missing the olaparib BEV arm of POLO-1. Now we have good historical comparison there. Another important aspect of that trial is that if you were found to have a BRCA mutation, you automatically went into a separate cohort of the triplet. And so there was no BRCA patients in these three arms. So very important differentiation on that trial. And what we found was that the main comparison showed that there was advantage in the HRD population. And then it went to the intent to treat, and there was also advantage in intent to treat. The challenge here is, again, when we look at the BRCA wild type, because these are all BRCA wild type, HRD positive. And then when we look at the sub-analysis, again, unplanned sub-analysis, the HRD test negative. And really, are we making a difference in those population of patients? As you may remember, I was actively involved in Mediola, which we presented a couple of times. Mediola was a platinum-sensitive treatment with these same three drugs as a combination and treatment. We hit almost 90% response rate in recurrent platinum-sensitive. Well, above what we'd expect in a treatment phase, particularly with outside of toxic chemotherapy. So I had great excitement with regards to the triplet, thinking that was the secret sauce. But when we look at the outcomes of this study in the HRD test negative, it really looks very similar to POLO-1. And we look at the HRD test negative, maybe a little bit of a hint there to improved outcomes, but not nearly what I was hoping for. And also challenging for us to say, how is this going to impact trying to use three drugs, the toxicity? I'm not even talking the financial toxicity, but the real toxicity here of three drugs with modest improvement. Now, Neil, you've heard me say a lot over the last several years. We really need to start talking about curative intent with advanced metastatic ovarian cancer. And truly, truly, not just survival advantage, not progression for your overall survival, but are we curing more patients? Where do those tails of the curve go? And if over time we see those tails of the curve flatten, where we are curing more patients with modest improvement in progression-free survival, which we've seen in other solid tumors, I will have a much different answer. But I want to see, are we curing more patients? Are we seeing those tails of the curve separate where we're really having a long-term benefit in the triplet arm?
So, and of course, you know, when you talk about that type of tail, everybody does think of checkpoint inhibitors. They hope that that's going to be the case. Are you waiting for more data, or at this point, do you feel like, you know, outside of MSI high, that checkpoint inhibitors are not going to have a role in ovarian cancer?
Usually, I would say people are dancing around that this is a negative study and they just need more data. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, listen, checkpoint inhibitors with a telltale, as you just alluded to, are these tails of the curve. And if we have a subpopulation of patients that benefit, now one of the challenges to DUO is they made the decision to look at the making an HRD question, But really, maybe what it needs to be is a PD-L1 expression question. And if we would have identified a group of patients who are more apt to respond, I do believe over time we may be able to differentiate in an unplanned sub-analysis, right? Which we have, you know, the FDA started approving drugs on unplanned sub-analysis, that we may be able to identify a group of patients that really will benefit the most from this triplet type of regimen.
And of course, people talk about TMB as another potential biomarker here, but I mean, at this point, do you see any evidence in ovarian cancer that there's correlation between benefit from checkpoint inhibitor and PD-1, TMB, or anything else?
Well, in the high-grade serous, if we look back at the JAVELIN data, there was in the a positive for 1 or 10 in the CPS scoring. We did see an interesting trend. Now, it wasn't adequately powered and with regards to, again, a subgroup analysis, but there definitely was differentiating in the curves, particularly in the greater than 10. So I do believe there is something there. Now, what percentage of patients will benefit? How big is that really? Well, it could be, particularly if you use 1+, and the DUO did report on their positive, which was the equivalent of CPS 1+, and they didn't really see much difference in that group of patients. So the question is, was that the right cutoff? But I do believe, looking at the JAVELIN data, that there is potentially a hint we could see benefit. And again, where are we going to see those in the tails of the curve? You know, I'm an optimist while at the same time I'm a pessimist. But in this case, I do think there's something there. I hope there's something there. Maybe it's more hopeful than it is reality.
And do you think in general the thought is that this study needs more follow-up before it's going to be, you know, FDA approved or come into practice? Or do you think based on this it might be approved?
I think the odds that it's approved with the current data is low. I think with more mature data, it would have a chance. But looking at the, you know, again, historical control, which they is what the FDA will hold this triplet combination to, it's the PAOLA-1 data. And does that make a difference within the HRD test negative, which the PAOLA-1 data is olaparib plus Bev, in that combination, HRD test negative, clear improvement when you add the laparib. But in the HRD test negative group, the curves were completely aligned. And the most updated output on the PAOLA-1 data with regards to HRD test negative, so there may have even been a benefit when you look at the overall survival in the Bev arm. So clearly, when we look at the historical control and HRD test negative, it's going to be held to the PAOLA-1 data. HRD test negative, it's a different threshold. It's really just Bev single agent. And did they, in that group of patients, improve the outcomes enough to get FDA indication? I'm pessimistic on this one.
From the point of view of docs in practice right now, I hear cases of where people have run out of options and they somehow managed to get an IO. I've heard people combining IOs and PARP, you know, outside a clinical trial. You know, it's always, you know, tempting to think about an IO in any patient with a solid tumor in the hope that maybe you'll get a long-term response. But do you think there is a role outside a clinical trial right now in a community-based setting for using a checkpoint inhibitor in ovarian cancer?
Outside of a clinical trial option, I think it's really hard to justify as a single agent. There's a couple of phase twos out there using combination, for example, Cytoxan Bev in IO, which showed some interesting results. I think as we look at the Mediola data, that was interesting results, but did not translate as well as we were hoping for in this phase three trial, the Duo-O. So outside of a clinical trial, unless TMB high, which you just said, you find MSI high, but that's going to be extremely rare in a high-grade serous, but you absolutely should test it in clear cell, mucinous, and endometrioid. 100% testing that, okay? But outside of those patients, I really find it difficult to justify utilizing IO therapy unless you have biomarker positive.
So you may remember from the meeting that we did at ASCO that one of the things that we were talking a lot about was a survey we did of 75 general medical oncologists, community-based practice prior to the meeting. And we actually asked them questions about a lot of different cancers, including ovarian cancer. And we included a number of cases and questions that they brought up. And I'm going to get into that in a couple of minutes. But first, just to kind of maybe again go back through what we've been talking about for several years now, which is, you know, basically right now how most investigators, including yourself, are thinking through the primary maintenance issue. And I want to start out when thinking about, let's say, BRCA or BRCA-like patients. So if you think about a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation, people who would be, you would sort of include in that group. And just to clarify that a little bit, so somatic BRCA?
Somatic BRCA or germline BRCA, you should treat the same right now. The data shows that they are going to really behave the same. So if you have a somatic or germline BRCA positive patient, and hopefully you're testing both germline and somatic, without debate, that patient should be offered a PARP inhibitor in the first line maintenance setting. The only debate in my mind is should you add Bev to that, like the POWL1 regimen. If you have a patient which is on Bev and you find that they're BRCA positive, I continue the Bev, and in this case, it would be a laparib because that's the only indication for the combination. So if I have a patient who's on Bev and I find they're BRCA positive, I continue the laparib. If you have a patient who is not on Bev, then single agent PARP inhibitor maintenance, absolutely 100%, is the standard of care. And unless a patient says, I am not willing to accept that therapy, I would say you're not adhering to the usual standards of treatment.
And in terms of, you said if the patient's on Bev, what is it that's going to get the patient on Bev? You know, I hear a lot about clinical factors like ascites, disease bulk, et cetera. How do you decide whether to use Bev?
Well, within the last year, and we talked about this at ASCO, I had an aha moment. And some of it was based on data. It was mostly based on data. It was Philip Harder's sub-analysis on a high-risk versus low-risk group of patients from POWL1. And they defined the typical high-risk type, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, stage 4, or disease at the end of primary debulking surgery. And they compared it to the other stage 3 patients. And they found that when you look at this low-risk group of patients, now remembering, Neil, low-risk advanced ovarian cancer, I'm not sure there exists a low-risk advanced ovarian cancer patients. 85% plus or minus 5% of low-risk are still going to recur, the same as high-risk, okay? So if you tell me or my family member they have an 85% chance of recurring, but you're low-risk, I call that into question. We actually just wrote a paper on that. Is there really a low-risk patient? So when we looked at the POWL1, again, unplanned subgroup analysis, not powered, right? But the outcomes were amazing when we looked at the low-risk patients. And it was just like a light bulb went off in my head. I said, why am I denying my best options for those patients with the highest chance of curative intent? And really, I think the hazard ratio on that was 0.1 in a low-risk patient in the HRD test positive when we looked at olaparib Bev versus Bev. And in those curves, I mean, you're curing a huge percentage of patients. Again, small number unplanned. So for me, with my intent to increase the opportunity for cure of intent for our patients, that aha moment was, I'm going to have the best therapies available to my patient at the right time, which is first line therapy. I'm going to use Bev for everybody. I'm going to test them, their tumor. If they have a BRCA or HRD test positive, I add olaparib. If they're HRD test negative, I alluded to this earlier, Bev seems to be at least as good of an option for PARP versus PARP inhibitor, and maybe a better option than PARP inhibitor in the first line setting in HRD test negative. So everybody in my practice in the first line setting, unless they have a contraindication, gets Bev, or I recommend it. It's ultimately the patient's decision. It comes to a shared decision. But in my heart, I am very comfortable in making that recommendation to my patients at this point, trying to give them the best chance of curative intent.
And that's both neoadjuvantly and, if they don't get neoadjuvant, adjuvantly?
Yes, sir. You know, I think we look at when to start Bev. If somebody comes in, big pleural effusions, ascites, I'm going to give Bev even in the neoadjuvant. And I usually do four cycles before. So most trials are 3 to 4 in the neoadjuvant. So if I'm giving them Bev, I'm starting off with those first 3 cycles. I skip Bev for the 4 cycles so it's not too close to surgery. And then I give them 3 to 4 more after their interval tumor reductive surgery.
And for patients who are BRCA wild type, HRD negative, would you ever consider adding niraparib to the Bev?
You know, we have some data that shows that it's safe. I'm not sure it adds a whole lot, particularly with regards to the current feelings about PARP inhibitors and the HRD test negative. It is an option. I try to stick to my recommendations for those patients with phase 3 data, when their phase 3 data is available. If it's not available, that's a different story. But we have multiple phase 3 trials here. In this case, one really, the Powell one with Bev and olaparib. And so I stick with that. If somebody said to me, this patient only wants to take pills once a day, and they wanted to utilize it, it's not outside because, you have a decent-sized phase 2 trial. The issue is the safety and the hypertension. You need to make sure they're checking their blood pressure a couple times a day, particularly with the niraparib and the Bev.
And then getting back to the BRCA-positive sort of situation, what other abnormalities for you are just the same as BRCA in terms of your thinking about PARP and specifically PALB2 and other mutations?
Yeah, you know, without debate in my mind, and I'm not getting NGS at the time of diagnosis on all my patients. I do on some, but I get it at recurrence. But if I know a patient is BRCA 1 or 2, RAD51, C or D, those seem to behave just the same as BRCA and maybe even more sensitive to PARP inhibitors. BRIP1, BARD1, you know, these are so rare in ovarian cancer that if I had that, it would, again, obviously push me over to utilize a PARP inhibitor in those patients. But most of those should already be HRD test positive. Those patients, BRIP, BARD, should also be HRD positive. So in the algorithm which I've discussed, where I add olaparib to Bev in any HRD test positive patient, they're going to get olaparib in that scenario, or a PARP inhibitor. I should say a PARP inhibitor. I'm using a lot of Bev, but I know there's some people who still are not buying into my algorithm.
I'm not sure if you commented on PALB2 specifically.
And PALB2. I mean, the same thing. Right. I did it. You're exactly right. The PALB2, BRIP, BARD, you know, those are such rare finds in ovarian cancer, but if you have it, if you had any doubt about utilizing a PARP inhibitor, in my mind, that should eliminate it in making sure. The best data is the RAD51 CRD. It's similar to BRCA at a little bit more higher incidence than PALB2, BRIP, and BARD.
How do you approach duration of PARP therapy in this primary setting? You know, the trials with niraparib, use it for 3 years. Do you use it for 3 years? Do you use olaparib for 2? How do you determine duration?
You know, I try to really have a shared decision with patients, particularly when you have, it's not contradictory, but it's difference in your schedule 2 versus 3 years. I tend, as I said, to have the combination of Bev PARP inhibitor, and I tend with the Bev to stick to a year and with the PARP 2 years. You know, I think with some of the worry on the length of exposure to PARP inhibitors and MDS and AML, that 2 to 3 years is very, very reasonable. There are certain patients who with advanced ovarian cancer know that there's no low risk group and would like to continue therapy. I think patients have the autonomy to make those decisions, but I tend to stick with either 2 to 3 years, favoring closer to 2 with the regimens that I've described.
You mentioned the issue of MDS and AML. What's the latest there, particularly in the primary maintenance setting and from the point of view of the absolute risk that we think is out there right now? How do you evaluate that?
Yeah, so in the first line setting in the trials, it's been unbelievably consistent where it's about 1 to 1.5% plus or minus, and plus or minus like 0.5%. So you're really looking at about 1 to 2% risk with platinum plus PARP. Okay. Now, when we look at the background risk before we utilizing PARPs, the background risk is probably about 0.5 to 1%. Okay. So we know that the platinum exposure is going to slightly increase AML and MDS risk. But very interestingly, then when we look at the platinum sensitive space, and now remember there's a big difference in our platinum sensitive maintenance, where the schedule was indefinitely to progression or toxicity. So rather than the 2 to 3 years in the frontline, the platinum sensitive, we went until progression or toxicity. So we just published a paper from the Aerial 3 data that I had the honor of being first author on, and we looked at what we described as are the extreme responders. And what do we mean by extreme responders? Well, we utilized the cutoff, which is, you know, double what the median was, of 2 years. So those that were treated beyond 2 years of therapy and had extreme response. And what do we find with regards to AML and MDS? Those that were treated beyond 2 years at extreme responders, we had a 10 to as high as 15% risk of AML and MDS. And that really, that data has really changed how I look at the length of treatment in even in the recurrent platinum sensitive space. So the algorithm that I've put into recommending in my practice, which is everybody with HRD gets a PARP in the first line, if they agree, if they think that's what's the decision for them. That leaves those HRD test negative patients not having exposure to PARP. Then we go to the clinical features, because that extreme responders paper very interestingly talked about the AML MDS rate. But what it also described is that the clinical features outside of BRCA and RAD51 CRD, outside of those molecular features, that the clinical features, complete response, normalization of CA125, or long platinum-free interval, was just as good as the molecular, if not better than HRD test negative. So now if I have a patient who recurred who's HRD test negative, but they have 18 months, and I give them platinum double, and they get a CR on CAT scan with normalization CA125, that patient is now acting BRCA-like to one of your earlier questions. That patient to me, based on data from, again, ancillary data, but this recent paper we just had in GY Oncology, that those clinical features are more important than the molecular features in the recurrent setting, now becomes the length of treatment. And I have to admit, Neil, even though the data says that all the phase 3 platinum sensitive maintenance had to continue to progression or toxicity, I have a very straightforward conversation with my patients at that year 2 to 3 mark. Do we want to stop therapy and watchful waiting at that? I know there's not data to support it. A lot of patients who have already occurred know that that PARP is keeping them from progressing and they're not willing to stop. But I have a very poignant conversation about the risk of AML and MDS, which unfortunately is almost always fatal in these patients.
It's really interesting, though, what you're saying. I read somewhere, it might have been in one of your papers, that, and I was kind of trying to figure it out, that there was a correlation between BRCA and development of MDS on PARP inhibitors. In other words, that people with BRCA were more likely to get MDS while on PARP, but I wonder if it's just that they're on treatment longer.
So it's interesting. Deb Armstrong wrote a very well-worded editorial to the paper that we had published.
And then you guys responded to it.
And it's interesting. It wasn't the BRCA. It was the length of exposure. And actually, those with germline BRCA were lower than somatic BRCA in the risk of AML-MDS. Again, not well confident. You know, there is no statistical analysis, but numerically was less. So I don't think it's germline BRCA putting us at a higher risk. I think it's those patients who are on more therapy, more platinum, right? And PARP longers. Those, both of those factors really impact. And who are those patients going to be more apt to be? Our BRCA and RAD51 CRD patients.
So I want to try to get into some of the I've already asked a bunch of the questions that we got from the survey, but I wanted to bring in a few more. One of the docs had a patient, 40 years old, stage 1C, but BRCA germline mutation. And the patient was asking about PARP in this situation. Any data?
So I just did a case report or a case series that was just published in GY Oncology Reports with one of my fellows, Dr. Monica Levine. And we basically looked back at our early stage patients, stage 1 and 2. As you know, the stage 2 patients were not included in the large randomized phase 3 trials. And it's a case series, and we looked, and those patients that did get a PARP, because we have had these conversations with our patients, particularly on our stage 2, which have at least a 30% recurrence rate, and depending on stage 1C, 15 to 20%, low as 10, as high as 20, depending on how many features and how well staged, it can even get a little bit higher, having those conversations about PARP inhibitors. And we found that the patients who had BRCA mutations and were exposed to PARPs, didn't recur. Small numbers, and that may not have recurred just based on the platinum doublet. But I have the conversation with patients, and these are real questions. Yes, is there any large randomized trials? No. Is there now a case series in the literature that may hint at advantage? Well, now there is. So I do have that conversation. I think this is where it comes down to shared decision making. Really real data about what your recurrence rate is. And if you recur, you will die of your disease. But when I have that conversation, I talk about those risks. And we've talked about a 1 to 1.5 risk of AML and MDS. And I talk to them about the risk of recurrence, and we have a shared decision. And many patients will elect for a PARP inhibitor. I don't know what the right answer is, but if that was my loved one and she had a 30% risk of recurrence, I'm going to talk to her at least some time period on PARP. Do we modify and go 1 year? Well, there's definitely no data on 1 year. So typically I stick with 2 years of therapy.
I'm always arguing with solid tumor people about adjuvant trials because, bladder, lung, obviously you do the trial in higher risk people, so you can get the answers quicker. But in breast cancer, once they did that, then they would just apply the risk reduction all the way down and try to make a decision. And the thing is, you guys are talking about a hazard rate of 0.3. Yeah. So you apply 0.3 to 30% or even 15%. And that's a lot of people avoiding recurrence.
Well, I think that's a really, when you talk about that, and you're going to talk about, again, the chance of getting rid of this cancer so it doesn't come back. And you're right, that hazard ratio of 0.3 and a 30% risk is to me, really makes a difference. And again, even a stage 1C. Now, 1A, probably not. I think that's where that slippery slope becomes. And you could argue the same slippery slope for stage 2, but there's no magic dome between the pelvis and the abdomen. In stage 2 are really stage 3. In my mind, there's really no debate about a stage 2 patient's being offered. Without data, I'm not going to, encourage it, but I'm going to have that conversation with patients. Stage 1 is much more unclear to me, but again, I'm going to have that conversation come with a shared decision.
So a couple other things brought up by quite a few of the docs in the survey. One, something we talked about all through ASCO, we did 10 meetings there, and every single one of them, I think we got into the issue of chemo shortage. And of course, GYN is one of the biggest areas where this is an issue. This seems to be continuously evolving, maybe even different now than a couple of months ago. Where are you right now, and what advice do you give? I don't even know what your situation might be at Ohio State, but in general, obviously you have issues where both Carbo and Sis are not available. For practical purposes, what are you advising people? I don't know if you have to deal with it yourself at Ohio State.
Yeah, we've had to change practices. Clearly, we want to reserve the platinum-based therapy for those who are curative intent. But we also want to reserve it for patients who have been shown to have overall survival intent, even if they're not curative. For example, recurrent patients and platinum sensitive. So we are dealing with it. We have a little bit more cisplatin than we have carboplatin. So I haven't had to yet make decisions in the primary treatment setting to say, well, I'm going to have to use cis rather than carbo. But my recommendations first, as is SGO and ASCO, is if you have more cisplatin and or no carboplatin, use cis over carbo. Obviously, the toxicity, we're going back old school here, nausea, peripheral neuropathy, a little bit better from hematologic, but really have to watch that. If you have no cis or carbo, the next choice is substitute with limited data. But I think with the importance of platinum agents in the ovarian cancer, oxaliplatin would be my next choice.
So another very common question is about the use of PARP inhibitors in later line situations and all the things that went on with the FDA. So a couple of questions. One, not so much related to that, but just in general, PARP after PARP, a patient who's had prior PARP, are there situations where you would use it again? You would think maybe one situation would be somebody who gets it primarily, has it stopped, and then recurs when they're not on it. So, I mean, that is one thing. But what about somebody who's progressing on a PARP inhibitor? Can you justify switching to another one or continuing and adding something or doing anything other than just not using it anymore?
Well, let's take those three questions. You know, if somebody's progressing on a PARP, switching to a different PARP, absolutely not, outside of clinical trial. So if you have a patient progressing, you're like, oh, I'm going to go from niraparib to olaparib or olaparib to niraparib. No. Okay. Unless it's part of a clinical trial. In that scenario, it's always going to be in combination with another agent. So absolutely not. I feel very strongly about that, obviously. Now, what also very interesting data, also Paolo 1, okay, presented at ESMO, just in a poster, it should have been an oral, or at least a discussion. They looked at, and you've heard me say this in the past, Neil, with regards to PARP exposure versus PARP resistance. Very important differentiation. They looked at the Paolo 1 data. Those patients who stopped a PARP based on treatment timelines or toxicity and then progressed afterwards looked exactly like the patient who had never had a PARP. But if you progressed on a PARP and then you looked at the response to platinum agents, they had a markedly less response rate or progression-free survivals, really. Okay. So there is something with the cross resistance on those patients who are resistant to PARP going on to become resistant to platinum. But that doesn't mean exposure results in resistance. And so the patient who's exposed stops for toxicity or because they had their 2 or 3 years of therapy. Absolutely 100%, I'm going to go back to a PARP in that patient. Would I go back in treatment rather than a platinum doublet? Probably not. Probably going to bring that platinum doublet back in and then use PARP maintenance after the platinum doublet. Okay. Now, in a patient who previously progressed on PARP outside of a clinical trial, so now they recurred and now you've given them platinum doublet and they have responded to the platinum doublet and the platinum sensitive and they previously progressed on a PARP. I am not going to go back to a PARP outside of a clinical trial in that patient.
So patients who've never had PARP inhibitors and have recurrent disease, first, I'm curious how often you see that nowadays. And second, can you kind of like distill out the whole FDA thing and come up with sort of a bottom line of in what situations do you use a PARP inhibitor and which situations that we used to use a PARP inhibitor do we no longer use a PARP inhibitor?
Well, we're in a weird spot because the NCCN guidelines are you know, one of the main guidelines that we look at do not align with the FDA guidelines right now. So in treatment, and I disagree, I have great respect and admiration for our FDA colleagues. They are colleagues, okay? But I don't know if I quite understand the decision that was made based on the data which was presented to remove later line opportunities for PARP patients. There are patients who come into our practices who have not had somatic or germline testing. We find that they're BRCA positive. And in the current FDA indications, they would not be allowed to have a PARP inhibitors. What do we still have in the platinum-sensitive space? In the platinum-sensitive maintenance, we still have rucaparib and niraparib for BRCA-positive patients. And olaparib still has an all-comer population. So you ask the question, what percentage of patients in my practice recur without seeing a PARP? And with the algorithm of the HRD test negative, not getting a PARP, 50%? 50%. Now, if they're BRCA positive, I hope that comes down to 0%, but there are still people who are not testing the tumor as well as they should. So 50% of the patients will come into the practice with recurrence who have not had a PARP inhibitor. And how many of those ultimately? Well, it depends on how they respond to platinum in the recurrent setting.
So let's talk a little bit about other agents used in ovarian cancer. And we have mirvetuximab antibody drug conjugate approved. Can you talk a little bit about what mirvetuximab is and right now where it fits into your practice?
Well, MIRV being an antibody drug conjugate to folate receptor alpha, the current phase 3 trial looked at MIRV versus physician choice and found that those at high folate receptor alpha, greater than 75% folate receptor alpha, using what's called the 2+ scoring, did markedly better both in progression-free and overall survival. And so we already had an accelerated approval. We suspect this is going to get full approval for MIRV. So all those patients who are platinum resistant and high folate receptor alpha expression should have MIRV as an option. What line is that? Again, once you find that they're no longer responding to platinum, then I would move it up to have our best therapies earlier on.
Any comments about tolerability with mirvetuximab, particularly ophthalmic issues?
Yeah, you know, the eye issues continue to be brought up. It's really interesting. We've now published the entire experience. Less than 1% of patients who are treated with MIRV have to stop the therapy due to the eye issues. We have gotten very good at partnering with our ophthalmologist based on TV, tizotumab vedotin. We've gotten much better at partnering with our ophthalmology colleagues with regards to regular examinations, which is needed with MIRV. And you basically have to use lubricating eye drops daily and then steroid eye drops around the time of the infusion. The side effects of blurred vision are very predictable and almost always occurring about cycle 2, day 7 to 14. So I tell my patients, you know, this is very predictable what's going to occur. Depending on the degree, will sometimes require a dose delay, even dose reduction. If it's just not that bothersome to the patient, they're able to go about and do their regular activities. I actually don't adjust the dose, and I will even treat through a grade 1. But I also, you know, do have a conversation with the ophthalmologist or even optometrist with regards to the side effects.
In terms of that, any other tolerability issues other than the ophthalmic that you want to comment on?
Well, the eye toxicity is what I get asked the most because it is somewhat unique. But, you know, we had this conversation in ASCO. You know, ADCs are chemotherapy. They're a smarter chemo. They're more personalized. They're a targeted chemo, but they are a chemo. The warhead is absolutely real. DM4 is a potent antimicrotubulin. So, you know, you have to watch, especially with chronic use neuropathy. It's not as pronounced as paclitaxel, but with the chronic utilization, you have to watch that. You do have to watch some GI, diarrhea or nausea. We do use pre-medications. Some people who don't need them, but again, we try to avoid and be proactive in making sure they do not have nausea and vomiting. It usually isn't, again, a significant issue. We see some patient with diarrhea, usually low grade. Every once in a while, you'll see a patient with a little bit more pronounced. And the hematologic, not usually, but you can see it. I have a patient right now who I'm delaying for tomorrow based on thrombocytopenia. So you can see it. It's usually not that pronounced, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, it's funny. When you said, I tell my patients this chemotherapy, all in my head, I heard a whole bunch of other investigators and other tumor types saying the same thing, because, you know, ADZs are now coming in, you know, everywhere. You know, there are two approved in bladder cancer. But also, the other thing that you hear is a lot of people responding. And I'm curious, what do you typically see with MIRV? Do most people respond?
Yeah, the waterfall plots are amazing. You know, you talk about response rates of 42%, which was the Mirasol, very consistent with our phase one. Also really interesting about, you know, usually when you start going to phase three, you don't have quite the response rate. Unbelievably consistent, right about 40% plus or minus a few percent, you know, up to five. But when you look, that's the 30% objective RECIST response, 42%. But when you look at those on the waterfall plot below 0%, you know, those who got clinical benefit, approaching 80%. And it's really impressive. I think 77% in Mirasol. And that's what I'm seeing. You know, and the data that we published on Forward 2, which is the MIRV plus BEV, it's almost 90% who get regression of disease. Okay. Now, obviously, those numbers where you hit the 30% objective response rate are different, and that's what we use for our bar. But when the patient outside of clinical trial is sitting in front of you and her disease has regressed 15% and her symptoms are better, you don't care if she didn't hit 30%. You're going to celebrate that and continue therapy until toxicity or disease progression.
Yeah, you mentioned MIRV plus BEV. I think that's the one that's being looked at. I always like cool trial names. I think it's called the Gloriosa trial.
Yeah, so the Gloriosa trial is, I'm honored to be the international lead for that trial. It is a platinum-sensitive maintenance. So patients who, as long as they don't progress on platinum, they have the option of going to BEV, and again, an active comparator arm, so they've had to have BEV with their platinum doublet versus MIRV BEV in those with high folate receptor alpha testing. So we'll screen those patients early. We want to bring MIRV as an option earlier lines of therapy, and this is an option right now in clinical trial. Hopefully in the future, it will be available to our patients outside of clinical trial.
Yeah, I mean, we have a first-line antibody-drug conjugate and diffuse large B-cell now. We did have it in Hodgkin until ASCO. Now I'm not sure about that. But hopefully, maybe MIRV will end up as part of the initial therapy. In terms of where things are heading, I was mentioning bladder has two antibody-drug conjugates, but there's another one in ovary that looks like it's very promising. I call it UPRI. Can you talk a little bit about what this is? What it targets, and what we know about it at this point.
UPRI is an antibody-drug conjugate against NaPi2b, sodium chain marker. And basically, it also has an antimicrotubulin warhead. It seems to be a higher percentage. Probably the high folate receptor alpha is about 35 to 40% in folate receptor alpha for patients. NaPi2b is probably closer to even 60% in their expression level cutoff. And so what we're doing is we're looking at this also in platinum resistant. We're waiting to see that data. But we also are looking at in a similar design as Gloriosa called Up Next in a platinum sensitive maintenance, but without BEV. So this is observation versus UPRI. So when we really look at this, again, an option for our patients get NaPi2b. Now, a very important point with regards to the company has announced, and this is publicly available, is it is in a safety hold right now with the FDA. It had a higher risk of bleeding, less than 1% grade 5 bleeding toxicities, but it was just less than 1%. So that currently is on hold. Enrollment on that trial is on hold. We are waiting to get more data on that. On that safety signal, and most likely will require an amendment to make sure that we're not putting patients on trial or who are getting treatment who are at a higher risk of bleeding. So very exciting agent, but right now we need to figure out some safety issues, namely bleeding, and more to come on that. But again, very excited about that, but we need to make sure it's safety at the foremost of our considerations.
Any thought about if there is an association with the mechanism would be?
It's interesting. It probably is endothelial cell damage. They also have some transient LFT increases, which seem to be non-clinically significant. And I was talking to some very smart people, and they said, well, that's really an endothelial damage. So we're not sure if it's an on target or off target, but there's definitely something that we need to make sure we're having our patients be safe for those at a high risk of bleeding.
So even though this is considered targeted therapy, there are a lot of ADCs where you give it to everybody, you know, and I'm curious, what do you see with NaPi2b low patients? Do they benefit at all?
Well, that's really what we're waiting to see on the final data. So the initial data presented by Deb Richardson now, I guess that's about a year and a half old from SGO. You know, we definitely saw patients with activity in the low expressors, but the level of activity in the higher expressors was markedly improved. Again, north of 40%. And you're looking at, you know, that 15 to 20% range in the low expressors. So again, a potentially active agent like MIRV and those that don't have high expression. But when we're really looking at, particularly on a targeted therapy, making sure we're identifying those patients who are going to have the highest opportunity for a positive efficacy and response.
What do you see in terms of tolerability toxicity with UpRi?
You know, overall, you don't have the eye toxicity, but you have a little bit more from a fatigue and GI standpoint. And so we really watch very closely. We actually will have visits with them weekly in the first couple of cycles to make sure they're tolerant well. If there's any questions at all, I make sure that we get dose reduced. The original dosing was at 42, and what we decided on from a safety standpoint and further development is at 36 for the platinum resistant patients. And that's really the dose that seems to be the optimized dose. Now, interestingly, because of the maintenance setting in Up Next and they're platinum sensitive, that they utilized 30 milligrams per meter squared in that trial and scenario, because the maintenance setting, obviously, the tolerance in a maintenance versus a treatment is going to be a different threshold.
You've used UpRi in clinical trials?
Yeah, I used it quite a bit. We were one of the highest enrollers in the previous trial.
What did you actually see in the patients in terms of quality of life?
The 36 was much better tolerated than the 42. And so, you know, when we started the more aggressive mitigation strategies, seeing them weekly, even bring them in for IV fluids, making sure, and then he didn't use the word aggressive dose reduction, but appropriate dose reduction in those patients who are having trouble tolerating it from a fatigue and GI standpoint, really made a marked difference in the tolerance. And the efficacy, again, you start hitting north of 40% in platinum resistance, it's really exciting. So figuring out, and we really have worked tirelessly to make sure that the mitigation strategies will help in the tolerance of UpRi.
So another topic that we talked about in the meeting, and I know you're one of the few docs I've run into who has any experience with this, Tumor Treating Fields. And of course, when we were talking at ASCO, we were mentioning the fact that we were looking forward to seeing the big lung paper in Tumor Treating Fields that was a positive study reported at ASCO. I don't know where that's heading. I'm probably going to be talked quite a bit about because it was a positive study in terms of progression-free survival. Can you talk a little bit first about what your vision is, about how your own vision about how Tumor Treating Fields works?
So speaking of antimicrotubulins, so, you know, the antibody-drug conjugates, our payloads, until just recently, have all been antimicrotubulins. We know disruption of these microtubules are important. We learned that from paclitaxel, one of the best regimens we have, right, or agents. The disruption of the Tumor Treating Field, which basically is opposing arrays, so you actually have these electronic currents, and they're set at the Hertz, which has been shown to work in ovarian cancer. You have disruption of the microtubules. But in this way, you're using energy rather than cytotoxic therapy. And so it's really interesting. Now, utilizing an array where you put on your skin and you're carrying a backpack for 18 hours, so you're not carrying it because you can plug it in when you sleep, is quite unique. But yet patients, you start talking to them about energy and changing the way patients really respond well. Some get freaked out, but patients respond really well. Like, this is cool stuff. I thought it was somewhat crazy when I first heard about it, and then started learning more about it and seeing what did GBM and now lung cancer. Remember the lung cancer data, overall survival benefit. This is what Innovate 3 is, our primary analysis, overall survival benefit. So in time, utilizing this technology with, in this trial, the trial we did, Innovate, was weekly paclitaxel. I envision in the future, this could be utilized with a whole series of other agents to try to maximize those benefits. Now, again, I'm getting a little out there. There's no data, and this is just O'Malley and thinking, right? But educating people how to utilize this, and then in time, finding where the best area is to fit this type of technology to help our patients.
So, you know, one of the questions we get about this in ovary and other cancers is the issue of, well, you're only applying this to a specific area. What about everything that's outside the area? But to me, I mean, it's just another form of debulking, like chemotherapy. Is that kind of the way you look at it? Or do you think that maybe somehow affecting what's under the arrays might have some indirect abscopal or some other effect on other disease?
Well, it does seem to, they have to be covered by the arrays. So if you have a patient who has brain disease and peritoneal disease, you know, it's probably not the patient I'm going to utilize, but the majority of our patients have diaphragmatic down to pelvic disease. Those arrays cover, okay? You have mediastinal disease and peritoneal disease. Again, probably not going to utilize the patient. Maybe we will in time as the arrays get to where we could utilize a couple different battery packs. But I don't look at it as a debulking. I look at it as a cytotoxic, okay? But in this case, it's a apparatus. It's an electric cytotoxic rather than a medicinal. And so when we have that therapy, it is a new mechanism. Yes, it's antimicrotubulin, but can we bring it in and overcome some of these resistance of our other agents with its antimicrotubulin effects? And really, over time, looking at how it works in patients post-paclitaxel will be a really interesting to evaluate in the future.
I always liked it because it was different. I mean, we used to go to Society of Neuro-Oncology, and we were going there when all this was happening, and we saw how people were reacting. But I just liked the fact that it was different. One of the other things that comes up, and we actually had a couple of patients that we presented at SGO who were on the Innovate 3 trial. And one of them had fairly significant dermatologic toxicity, I guess irritation from the arrays. Any comments on what you've seen? My understanding is you just don't use the arrays for a while and it usually gets better. But how much of a problem is the skin?
Well, you know, it was a unique, like when we first evaluated eye toxicity with ADCs, you know, we're not dermatologists, we're not ophthalmologists, right? Well, I'm also not a rheumatologist, but I've gotten pretty good at IO associated toxicities. It is unique. You have the direct irritation, and then you're, unlike the head, you have a lot more movements. So you have some shearing forces. And so the toxicity, there's kind of three different ones, right? Which is you have almost, they will heat up a little bit, not too bad, but they will heat up. So you have this heat in the sweat. And then you have the local dermatitis, almost an allergic like, and that's why we move the arrays by 1 centimeter every time we apply them. But then you can also have this irritation, kind of shearing type abrasion. That would be the term, abrasion. And so depends on what the toxicity are. We are going to continue to learn about how to best take care of the skin. Hopefully, if the trial is positive, I hope it is, because it gives our patients another option. And what else has happened? They've gotten the next generation of arrays. They seem to be much more, what's the word? They move better with the skin, okay? Hmm. So they're taking the next generation. Over time, I imagine almost a vest that we could really, to your point, place that anywhere to allow for the arrays to have effects at those areas of involvement.
So just a final question I want to ask you. I know you're really deeply in the middle of clinical research in the area. Any new agents or therapies that you're looking at, you're excited about? I got to ask you about, speaking of hard to pronounce, ubamatamab. a MUC16CD3 bispecific. That sounds pretty cool.
We've actually now presented that a couple of times, presented at ESMO last year. And we presented the single agent activity. Clearly there's clinical benefit. Modest, we hit about 20% objective response rate, a little bit less than that. But the clinical benefit rate in this group of patients was really pronounced. So speaking of your question earlier in this conversation, with regards to combining it with, for example, a PD-1 inhibitor, okay? So they have cemiplimab. Okay. And so we're connecting the CD3, right, with the immune cells. We're connecting it to the cancer cells. We're bringing those cells in proximity to the cancer cells and then bringing the PD-1 inhibitor to remove the blockers. And so we haven't yet seen the combination data, but we're really excited to see, you know, where that's going into that next generation of bispecific antibodies potentially combined with PD-1 inhibitors. That to me is really exciting. And we're seeing some exciting results. The cytokine releasing syndrome, it seems to be mild. We've learned that if we slowly increase the doses, we overcome that. We're not seeing the severe CRSs that they've seen in other bispecifics. So it's a really exciting clinical activity. We're going to continue to refine how we're going to utilize it. And if it's a single or in combination, most likely be in combination. And I think it's a drug that is going to potentially benefit our patients in the future.
Any other new exciting areas? CAR T?
I tell you, I can't believe we're going to have a CAR T trial. We actually have our first site open. I just heard Oklahoma is open. And it's an interesting group of patients. It's both HLA subtyping. And so when we look into that group of patients, it has potential benefit in patients with platinum resistant. Really impressive early clinical trials that we are going to have a large phase trial, which is going to answer this question.
Any other new agents or strategies you want to comment on?
Well, you know, antibody drug conjugates continues to be exciting. You know, we're seeing smarter and smarter molecular targeted therapies, and we're going to continue to talk about those. Some of those are not yet in the public domain, so I'll make sure I let you know. But we're going to continue to see these targeted therapies and these molecular subtypes, which are really going to allow us to have more precision oncology like we see in our hematologic malignancies and some of our other solid tumors like lung cancer.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. O'Malley, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.